I've tweeted and I've talked about it, and I challenge my other artists to, and people out there to put the focus on that. But I can't just say that. I can't just say that from a protracted, abstract place. I gotta put myself here in order for people to really hear me and say that. And I gotta be able to speak on it from a firsthand experience, or else I could be considered guilty of the same thing.
Hip-hop star Talib Kweli and Rosa Clemente speaking in Ferguson, Missouri. Visit our website to watch the full interview. Special thanks to Aaron Mate, Hani Massoud, Messiah Rhodes, Nikai Cruz, Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder. Happy birthday to Vesta Guedars, and a belated happy birthday to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8 o'clock. Coming up next is more talk radio with our host, Cecil Prescott. Today's guest is militarism and civil liberties activist Elizabeth Beavers, in to talk about Ferguson and military policing.
As more and more of our men and women get caught up in the system of mass incarceration, the effect on family members cannot be ignored. Tune in to Prison Pipeline on August 25th at 6:30 p.m. to hear host Amy Johnson speak with members of Mothers of Incarcerated Sons Society. MISS is a group for people who are dealing with the incarceration of a loved one.
By them all in the ground, I'd root that mountain down, and I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Tune in to KBOO Monday mornings at 9 for the Old Mole Variety Hour, your source for radically democratic news, views, reviews, and interviews, stories of ordinary and extraordinary people working to root down the oppressive institutions of capitalism. That's the Old Mole Variety Hour, Monday mornings at 9.
Good morning. Today is Monday, August 25th, 2014, and you are listening to KBOO, your community radio station, 104.3 in Corvallis, in Hood River, 91.9, in the Portland metro area is 90.7, and via the World Wide Web, it is kboo.fm. This is More Talk Radio, and my name is Cecil Prescott. Recently, the nation has become aware of the militarization of the police. Television and video shots of what has happened in Ferguson, Missouri, has raised the perspective and has increased the outrage and caused people to question what is happening to our police and how are they suddenly becoming militarized. Our guest this morning has written extensively about this subject. She has written about the militarism of the police. Elizabeth Beaver is the legislative associate and militarism and civil liberties for the Friends Committee on National Legislation. She is the recent article, co-author of the article entitled "Get the Military Off of Main Street: Ferguson Shows the Risk of Militarized Policing." Thank you for joining us, Ms. Beavers.
Thanks so much for having me. Glad to be here.
Well, thank you for your work. And as I mentioned in our introduction, for many people who may not have been aware, and I think most of our audience is, the recent images coming from Ferguson, Missouri has raised concern about what is happening to our police and increased militarization that seems to characterize much of local police throughout the nation. So I read recently that here in Oregon, We have been the recipient of $10.7 million in surplus military gears for various local police units throughout the state. And this program is something that has some history. Could you give us a little bit about the history of the transfer of defense, Department of Defense equipment to local police units throughout the United States?
Yeah, sure. So this federal program is actually called the 1033 program, and it was established by Congress in 1996. It was part of a much broader defense authorization bill, and it was kind of stuck in there in Section 1033, actually, which is how the program got its name. And what it did is simply to enable the Pentagon, the Department of Defense, to transfer its surplus military weapons and equipment to local police officers and law enforcement units all over the country at no cost. So this means that as soon as the program was established, whenever something has been declared surplus by the Department of Defense, law enforcement agents are able to order extra equipment, extra weapons, and they don't have to pay for it. Now that we have the internet, it's literally kind of like online shopping. They're able to log on and choose what they want, and there's a whole range of equipment available to them, from huge mine-resistant, ambush-protected vehicles that look a lot like tanks to M16s, assault rifles, grenades, these long-range acoustic devices. All of these things we're seeing in Ferguson, it didn't happen overnight. It's been since 1996 that this program has been in existence. And since then, almost $5 billion worth of equipment has been transferred to all 50 U.S. states, to four U.S. territories, small towns, major cities. Nobody's exempt. Everybody's been taking advantage of this.
I even read that some university, I read that Ohio State University has been the recipient of some of this military excess.
That's exactly right. And that's something that was really shocking for a lot of people. It was at the end of last year. And to date, they're the only university. But Ohio State University received one of those huge MRAPs through the program, which is shocking in pictures to see it parked on a college campus like that. And I think, of course, knowing the history of skirmishes between protesters on college campuses with campus police or local police, it's something that's really terrifying for the potential.
Now, you mentioned, you know, with the internet, there's this sort of like online shopping. And so I guess they local law enforcement pay a fee to join, and then there's this online shopping. Are there any restrictions in terms of what they can order, and also what type of training do they receive, if any?
Sure. So there actually is no fee to join. As you mentioned, they just kind of look at the equipment that's available, and there's a one-page application that they fill out. And they go through their state coordinator. Each state has a coordinator that's appointed by the governor that oversees the transfer of weapons and equipment for that particular state. So that's the office that they operate out of. And there really aren't restrictions. It just depends on what becomes available. And I will say that some of the items are perfectly benign, such as, you know, microwaves and file cabinets and office supplies and things like that. But the most transferred item is the M16. As I said, there have been these giant MRAPs, there's grenades, there's all kinds of things that were specifically designed for combat, specifically designed for destruction in the war zone, and were never meant for law enforcement. And so you also mentioned the training piece, and they're, at least from the DOD side, they're not responsible, or they don't have any sort of restrictions in place in terms of who can receive what by way of training. That's something that's the responsibility of local law enforcement to determine, are they ready to take on this equipment, and do they know what to do with it once they have it? And, you know, we've seen all over the country lots of evidence that they're not ready to use it, and that they inappropriately use it once they receive it.
You're listening to KBOO. This is More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott, and we're speaking with Elizabeth Beavers about the militarism of local police. Let me give you our numbers so that you may speak with Ms. Beavers. Our numbers are 503-231-8187, or you may email us at moretalkradio@gmail.com. Now, you mentioned the 1033 program started in 1997. Now, that is certainly a few years before what was the 9/11 incident in the United States. So this happened before the increased awareness or fear of terrorism. Is that correct?
That is correct, but it's ramped up in recent years because of that, both from the mentality of fear that we've been operating out of as we've responded to the threat of terror, like anything else, whether it's our foreign policy or right now it's become domestic policy as well. We have a military-first mindset that if there's a threat, then the first and most obvious answer always seems to be to engage the military. And so that's actually one of the main justifications that are cited in asking for this equipment. Local law enforcement will say, well, you know, perhaps there's a threat of terror or there's some sort of possibility that our town or our city might be exposed to terrorism, and so we need this MRAP. And then, so, you know, there's an MRAP that goes to, you know, like Fargo, where, you know, they haven't haven't had a lot of terrorism. And, you know, it almost starts to look comical because there are these absolute worst case scenarios that are cited when, in fact, you know, the most, you know, the biggest security threat that one town that received it, all they have is kind of like their annual pumpkin festival that they need security for. So, yeah, but I mean, there's a connection there because the way we responded to September 11th, as we all know, is to engage in this unchecked global war on terrorism. And these are the exact weapons that were dispatched to deal with that are coming home now, because as we're winding down these huge wars, Iraq, Afghanistan, that's where all these things are going. It's surplus equipment that's no longer being used, and so it's being given directly to law enforcement.
And I think you and your associates make a very good connection between what's happening in terms of these excess military equipment being used by local law enforcement and the threat on something very basic in civil liberties. Can you speak a little bit about that connection?
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, the equipment and the weapons themselves are obviously terrifying. It's just quite simply not the responsibility of law enforcement to engage in militaristic tactics or to possess those weapons. But the greater sense here is that, okay, so what happens when they have them, when they use them? And, you know, we've seen some real threats to basic Fourth Amendment rights of freedom in your home, privacy in your home, the due process that you're enabled to under the Constitution. You know, Ferguson actually is kind of an outlier in the way this equipment is used, because this is a major protest, crowd control, chaotic sort of situation. The reality is that the majority of use of these weapons and equipment happen in day-to-day policing. It's low-level drug raids, it's search warrants, it's things that there's no reason to barge into someone's home with a grenade, and which is something that happened in Georgia a few months ago that got a lot of media coverage because it was such a tragic incident. The police broke into a home and threw a flashbang grenade, and it landed in a baby's crib and injured the child. And it was all over a $50 marijuana transaction, and the person who was the suspect wasn't even home. So there's all sorts of privacy concerns here and basic rights that people are entitled to. And you know, the responsibility of police is to protect and serve. They are a part of the community. They are not in opposition to the community. And it's really difficult for people to feel the level of safety that they're entitled to when the people who are there to protect them seem to suddenly become the enemy.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO, your community radio station. My name is Cecil Prescott, and we're speaking with Elizabeth Beavers with the Friends Committee on National Legislation. Give us a call at 503-231-8187. I had a brain freeze. moretalkradio@gmail.com. Are you concerned about the militarization of police and what is saying about our nation? Let's go to a caller. Brian, thank you for calling.
Yes, good morning. So I'd like to say something and throw something into conversation here. Back in just before Bush left office, he had, and this was reported by Amy Goodman, he had pulled back a brigade of troops from Afghanistan or Iraq and sent them to Ohio and was training them in civil unrest. And that was, you know, I mean, it was a footnote for Amy Goodman in the morning one day. Never heard anything else about that. But I would like to say something about our current situation. And my left side, where I'm at, on the left side here, and where I plan to stay, is our fault in this is we are, and please forgive me, I don't mean to insult you at all, your guest, but we keep analyzing this. We keep racking up the statistics. We keep documenting everything. Well, I think it's time to start looking at our intellectuals to start start finding ways to stop this. You know, I mean, through, you know, there has to be a way. I mean, it is, we are not going to be allowed to document it pretty soon, you know, and if we are, it's just going to be a joke. And I think with all these murders and all, every time there's a murder, we just go into this phase where we document everything, we discuss it, we have the quote unquote conversation, you know. And I'm not advocating that we go out and hurt anybody over it, but at the same time there has to be some action and some blowback by the left wing in this country. Now there's one more thing I have to say. I hired this president by my vote to be a representative of my beliefs and general left-wing beliefs. And I hired him, and one of the reasons why I hired him is because he is black and because he has a deep understanding of what's going on. He worked in the Chicago political scene. He worked under Harold Washington. And he knows what is going on. Everybody knew what was coming if it was allowed to progress. And this man, unfortunately, you know, to all of our disappointments, has just allowed so much to go on, and it's critical. And at this point, I really don't want to document any more stuff. I mean, the world has already said we are involved in a genocide in the Middle East, you know, on the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. We are guilty already of war crimes. Some of our people in highest office are guilty of war crimes. And, you know, I asked, along with the rest of our left-wing people, of this president to turn our country into what it really is. It's what it's supposed to be.
Okay, Brian, I don't want
but
to
anyway,
cut you
I'm,
off.
I'm going to let you go, and I'm sorry I went on like that.
That's okay.
It's very upsetting to me to see us just sit there and just document murder after murder.
Okay, well, thank you, Brian. He raises several good points, Ms. Beavers. You're with the Friends Committee on National Legislation, and certainly one thing he suggested is a cause to action. I understand that Representative Hank Johnson has a proposal to look at this 1033 program. Can you speak about that?
Yeah. I don't know if Brian can still hear us, but I'm really glad he raised a lot of those issues. There's so many really delicate issues here, but I really, really agree with him that the time to document, it's well passed over. We absolutely have to spring to action and try to do something to actually stop this. And that's right. So my organization is an advocacy organization. We don't, you know, produce long reports for people to put on shelves. What we do is... our value add is to talk to people in Congress and to ask them to change things. And for nearly a year now, we've been asking for Congress to look at the 1033 program and to address the militarization of police. And months ago, it was Congressman Hank Johnson who stepped forward to take leadership and to agree to introduce a bill to reform the 1033 program. So, yeah, that's exactly right. So I hope everyone listening will encourage their lawmakers to support the Stop Militarizing Law Enforcement Act. What it will do is it will block the transfer of this military-grade equipment, and it lists out specifically, so there's no confusion, the mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicles, the grenade launchers, the assault weapons, the assault rifles. And then the second thing it does is it it adds a level of accountability and a system of reporting and certification to ensure that law enforcement who receive these items are no longer capable of losing them, of selling them, of all these sorts of things that have been documented across the country, and that in addition to getting this privilege of having free military equipment, they're also being asked to exercise some responsibility. It's a fantastic bill. We're very supportive of it. And that's our top priority right now, is building support for the Stop Militarizing Law Enforcement Act.
Excellent. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. What do you think we should do about the militarization of the police? Let's go to Deanna. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for this extremely important conversation. And I would like to simply add my voice to Brian's and say, well, I don't think the president is the only one to blame. Certainly everything else he said is absolutely valid. And to Ms. Beavers, thank you very much for your work. How important. And I would like to raise this question for everyone to consider. The police are here to protect and serve. I believe you said. That's what I heard. I believe that is what we all think. And I'm going to ask you, who is the police here to protect and serve? It is most clear, if we can judge by actions and not by any kind of nonsense like statements, the police are here to protect and serve private property. They are not here to protect and serve citizens, as evidenced by what they do. Please respond to this. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you. Ms. Beavers, did you hear her thoughts?
Yes, it sounded like she was making a distinction between the protection of private property versus protection of citizens. One thing I want to make sure to say as we talk about the subject, we're talking a lot about law enforcement, and I want to reemphasize that the point of this whole discussion is not that the police are bad guys or that they have malicious intent or that law enforcement as a whole is something that's unjust or something that has gone awry. The point is that law enforcement and the military are two separate institutions, mm-hmm. and they have separate mandates, and they should be held to different standards because they have two completely different purposes, and that goes exactly what our caller was saying, which is that the military, their purpose is to fight an enemy, to act in opposition to a group of people. The police, their purpose is mm-hmm. to protect a community, to be part of a community, mm-hmm. to work alongside them to bring about law and order. That is their purpose. Mm-hmm. Certainly, property interests go into that, and there are all sorts of other side issues that come up as we try to hold our officials accountable to actually act out their mandate of protecting and serving. But, you know, we have a good friend that we work with often. His name is Norm Stamper, and he used to be the chief of police in Seattle mm-hmm. during that infamous Battle of Seattle in the 90s.
Yes, 1999.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and which ties in perfectly with what we're talking about and shows that these sort of militarized tactics have been happening for quite a while. But he came with us to a congressional briefing that we did about a month ago where we were trying to educate lawmakers about the 1033 program and asking for some action on the Stop Militarizing Law Enforcement Act. And this was before Ferguson happened. And Mr. Stamper talked about authorizing those militarized tactics and the chaos that they caused in the community and how it's the biggest regret of his life and his career. And he advocates now for a peaceful community policing and investing in the ability of officers to actually engage with the community and be a part of them rather than acting in opposition to them and treating them like they're an armed enemy. So, even I think law enforcement can agree with what we're saying, is that the point is to de-escalate and to find a peaceful solution, and introducing violence and militarized tactics works in opposition to their purpose.
I think that both of you, you and the caller, raise a very important point in that looking at the separate duties and responsibilities of the military and the police. And certainly the military is ostensibly there to fight an enemy. When you have that mentality, or certainly that equipment, which may encourage that mentality in local communities, I can easily see how rather than seeing their responsibility as protecting and serving the community, as viewing or responding to the community as the enemy, and that creates increased tensions and make it more difficult to do their proper duty. We're speaking with Elizabeth Beavers of the Friends Committee on National Legislation. She is speaking about the militarization of the police. Let me encourage your calls and comments, what you think about the increased militarizations of the police and what we should do about that. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. You mentioned about going before Congress and asking for them to review and reconsider reforming this piece of legislation. Over the weekend, we learned that the president has called for a comprehensive review of the government policy of outfitting police with military weapons. Any thoughts or recommendation about how that review should go about? What issues that they should look into?
Yeah, it was really great news to hear that finally from the top down this is going to get the review that it's been deserving for several years. I want to reemphasize, and I know I already covered this, but in addition to the obvious problematic militarization that this program causes, there's also been just this tremendous amount of waste, fraud, and abuse that's sprung up as a result of the total lack of oversight. Mm. It's one thing to hand out surplus military equipment to local law enforcement, and it's another thing altogether once you hand it out to completely ignore what's done with it or who has it. These are not isolated incidents. In Indiana alone, 11 jurisdictions have been suspended from the program because they can't account for the military weapons that they received. One law enforcement unit can't account for the Humvee that they acquired through the program. Others have, in my home state of North Carolina, an official was found guilty of selling about $35,000 worth of M16s that he received through the program on eBay. It's just completely run amok. These weapons are going into a totally uncontrolled flow, which is extremely dangerous, obviously. I mean, it's one thing for law enforcement to receive them and not have training, but for just average citizens to maybe... for this to slip through the cracks and just kind of flow totally unauthorized into other hands, it's something that's really dangerous and it's irresponsible. Mm-hmm. So I hope that the review will focus on the failures of the Department of Defense in the last few years to account for what they're handing out for free through this program. I hope that they'll take an honest look at what's been transferred, and I also hope that they'll ask the questions of why we have so much surplus equipment in the first mm-hmm. place. Because that's a really important question to ask. Why is there almost $5 billion worth of military equipment that is available, both brand new and used, that's available for law enforcement to snatch up in the last few years? You know, we have some theories. We think that one of the main things are these enormous defense contracts that we're procuring that's become almost sort of a jobs program. All across the country, there are, you know, huge defense manufacturing that Congress is protecting by continuously ordering more weapons and equipment that the military doesn't need, sometimes says it doesn't need. And so we have all these extra things, and, you know, by giving them away for free, it just increases that demand and allows Congress to order more contracts. So you know, I hope that all these root causes are examined really honestly and really thoroughly, and we look forward to that review. But in the meantime, we think that if lawmakers are really concerned about what's happened in Ferguson and they don't want to see it happen in their own jurisdiction, they should support the Stop Militarizing Law Enforcement Act, because, you know, we don't need a review to tell us that police shouldn't have the items that are on the list in this bill, and they certainly should have to account for what they already have. So these are things that don't need a review, and it's steps that can be taken right now.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. We're speaking with Elizabeth Beavers of the Friends National Committee on... Oh, give me your title again. Friends National Committee.
Friends Committee on National Legislation. That's
right,
it.
Right. And, you know, I love the Quakers. So I went to a Quaker school.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, I did in Pennsylvania. But that's another story.
Oh, fantastic.
Speaking about how this equipment is used, here in Oregon, the Springfield Police Department received in January 2013 equipment that they eventually paid to have it removed. The agency is now looking to send back the Humvee valued at nearly $73,000 because it doesn't fit its needs. And one question I have, you know, if a police department gets something that they don't need, will they find a reason to use it because it's just sitting there collecting dust? And
right. Well, and yeah. So one thing that I think a lot of people don't realize is that the current regulations of the program, and this is shocking, actually require that police use what they receive within 1 year.
Yes.
That's a condition of receipt of something. So that's another thing that the Stop Militarizing Law Enforcement Act will do, is it will strike that regulation and eliminate that from the current law, because that is absolutely inappropriate to require that police units use any sort of weapons. But they certainly can't require them to use their you know, mine resistant, ambush protected vehicles and all these other sort of things. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, just raise a question. So if they're, you know, it's coming up on 11 months. We haven't used this Humvee with all these guns attached to it. So there's a demo outside. We have to use it? And do they just check off that they used it? And how does that work?
Yeah, well, you know, like anything else in this program, there's not a lot of uniform enforcement. Mm-hmm. So particularly with some of the stranger items that are being received, I'm sure that they're not being used within the 1 year mark. But you know, some jurisdictions are using a very loose definition of use, and they're, you know, maybe putting them out in a parade, or you know, kind of propping them up as an accessory or something like that. But it is really scary to know that one of the conditions of receiving, you know, an assault rifle is that you have to use it within a year. And whether that's checked or not, that's something that law enforcement is certifying that they agree to do when they receive it. You know, and I will just highlight that there are some really silly items that go through this. There's lots of reports have come out in the last few days, and of course we don't want to make light because this is a very serious program. It's a serious problem, but it's comical that, you know, a small town in Georgia can order a warehouse full of bayonets for use in their, you know, 500 person town. or that I saw someone else was ordering a huge arsenal of dog goggles. Goggles for the
yeah.
And bouncy houses and all sorts of things that are just kind of funny. So you know, I think when things are free, the threshold for considering whether you really need it or not is pretty low. And you know, that's something I keep reminding everyone, is what we're trying to do through this bill is just raise the threshold and ask police units to consider, is this something your unit needs? Is it something you're capable of using? Is it something that you're prepared to use in a responsible way before getting it? And if you're not getting it for free, then I think they're going to have to take that under consideration more than they are now.
Yes, thank you. Let's go to another caller. Steve, good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, great subject and good conversation. I got a question about the, say, the mayor of these municipalities that get this military equipment, since they are the, quote, commissioner, police commissioner, can they refuse this? Can they say, no, we don't want any of this, send it back? Can they actually do that, or do they have the power to do that versus the police department? I'm just curious, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you. So how does this program work? They certainly request specific equipment, is that correct, rather than it just being sent to them?
Yeah, that's right. They have to specifically ask for it, although I will say that sometimes they don't always get what they ordered. Mm-hmm. I think it was in Nashville where the police ordered 50, I think it was M16s, and they received 500. Mm-hmm. And so now they kind of joke, they have each police officer has one for each arm with some to spare. So, you know, they maybe don't always get exactly what they bargained for, and they, you know, they have to keep in mind that what they're ordering, they're getting it as is. So they might get brand new equipment, and they might get failing used equipment that they have to actually spend a lot of local taxpayer money to fix and to maintain. So even though it is for free, you know, sometimes that's a little deceptive. But to his question about who has the authority to refuse this, to my understanding right now, it's quite simply the law enforcement agency sends in their one-page application to the state coordinator, and it's the state coordinator and the DOD who makes those decisions and either approves or doesn't approve the transfer, and it's simply a transaction between local law enforcement and the DOD through the state coordinator's office.
Wow.
So that's the only two parties that that are in the decision making process.
Here in Oregon, the state coordinator is Steve Smith, and I understand that local law enforcement agency must pay an annual enrollment fee ranging from $500 to $2,000. Then they have access to the online database where they can look and check off what they want. But we're speaking with Elizabeth Beavers of the Friends Committee on National Legislation. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. Give us a call about your thoughts about the militarization of the police, local police, and what we should do about that. Now, this 1033 program is run out of the Department of Defense, which is separate than the Department for Homeland Security, which issues terrorism grants. Can you speak anything about the Homeland Security program? Is it any way related to this 1033 program?
Well, it's related in the sense that it comes from the same mentality, which is basically the politics of fear, of being concerned about letting the fears of terrorism come through to the extent that we're willing to shell out any money necessary to make sure that everyone is armed. Law enforcement agencies are armed like soldiers, and it's enormous. It eclipses the 1033 program, at least in terms of dollars. The 1033 program has given out over $4 billion worth of equipment, whereas these terrorism grants, almost $35 billion have been handed out. Mm-hmm. And these are a lot more difficult to deal with legislatively because this is direct cash that's being handed out to local police who then use the money to purchase equipment for themselves, and then it's theirs. It's not like the 1033 program where the items belong to the Department of Defense, and mm-hmm. technically they're on loan to local law enforcement, and it's, you know, within the purview of DOD if they ever did decide to recall that or to take it back. It's still their equipment. But what they purchase through these terrorism grants, it's the property of local law enforcement. We've seen just unbelievable things that have been ordered, that have been purchased because of this money. Things, these are where some of the drones are coming into law enforcement, mm-hmm. Especially on border states. There are, like, you know, bomb detecting robots and all sorts of sophisticated machinery and equipment that, again, almost no oversight. Once the money's handed out, it's then the responsibility of local law enforcement to purchase something responsible and to use it responsibly. And I think we can see how that's gone.
You're listening to More Talk Radio on KBOO-FM. This is Cecil Prescott. I'm speaking with Elizabeth Beavers. She is with the Quaker Lobby organization, the Friends Committee on National Legislation. Give us a call on your thoughts and solution about the militarization of local police. Let's go to Michael. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. First of all, Cecil, I want to say that all this military equipment, I think one of the reasons why it's in effect is because it's only being used on a select group of people. If they were using this equipment on white people, they would hurry up and get rid of it. But because they're using it on poor minorities, then there's not this big national outcry to get rid of it. And another thing that's really ironic is that when these equipment is in the hands of the military, the people that is operating this equipment are minorities and poor whites. They're the ones that's in the military because it's volunteer, and they're the ones that's on the front lines fighting. But then when this equipment comes to the police department, then all of a sudden the demographics changes. Mm-hmm. Now the equipment falls in the hands of predominantly white white clientele. And it's ironic that the people that's doing the most killing in this society on the police department are white males. You don't hear about white female policemen killing people. You don't hear about black policemen killing people, Chinese police. It's just the white male. So that's my take on it. I'll talk to you later, man.
Okay, thanks a lot. Yes, a lot about our society is is ironic. And thank you for those thoughts, Michael. Let's go to another caller. BJ, good morning.
Yeah. Well, there's more to it than that. It's how to spend the taxpayers' money. The defense industry, and I work for them, has contracts, and they have to fulfill them, and they have to get it from the taxpayer. And they don't care about minorities or this or that. It's the taxpayer that pays to build all this stuff, make it. And if they can't use it in a foreign country, they still order 10,000 bayonets and 50,000 M16s or what have you. And you know, I was in the Army a long time. I saw it happening there. We have presidents of the United States and five of our generals talk about this. Beware of the military complex. This is what it really boils down to, is our military complex. I mean, you know, you can talk about issues of all kinds of, you know, I'm a Native American myself. I know what it is to be subjected to. But I'd just like to say, though, that our real issues are that if we get all worked up about these things, you know, I can go to the armory behind me and buy a Jeep at a discount rate on the black market. Some guy will sell me one because they have so much military complex. There's no room for, they have two tanks in there. There's no room for another military vehicle, mm-hmm. especially in Portland. They filled Portland up with a lot of military vehicles for some reason.
Yeah.
Or maybe they just have a lot of them. What's your comment on that?
Hey, thank you. Your thoughts on his observation about the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned us about 60 years ago?
Yeah, both of these callers are raising enormous issues here that we can't ignore. It's certainly not enough to talk about the 1033 program, and for all of its troubles, it's troubled because we have other issues. We have other problems that we have to deal with. And one of those, obviously, it's extremely difficult to ignore the racial undertones to some of these things, especially, I want to highlight that, again, the majority of these weapons and these tactics are used in prosecuting the drug war. Mm-hmm. It's low-level drug raids where these are happening, where SWAT teams are being sent out unnecessarily. And we already know that the drug war and the resulting prosecutions disproportionately affects communities of color. It stands to reason that the use of the 1033 program through this routine everyday policing and carrying out the drug war, it has the same effect. And just even listen to that language, the drug war. It's the mm-hmm. war on drugs. We've been telling police for decades now that they're fighting a war, mm-hmm. And now we're equipping them to fight a war, and we're including in the war on drugs the war on terror. So I guess we shouldn't be so surprised after so many years of equipping them like soldiers and telling them they're fighting a war that they begin to fight and they begin to act as if they are soldiers. I do want to address the other point, which is something I started to comment on a little earlier, which is that why do we have so much surplus equipment in the first place? And that's exactly what this caller has brought up, that we have enormous contracts in the defense industry. And you have to fulfill those. You have to purchase these things whether the military needs them or wants them or not. And the 1033 program opens up, and the grants through DHS as well, opens up a whole other avenue to hand out equipment, to hand out weapons that can help create a demand within the Pentagon to justify more contracts and ordering more equipment. So it's a self-perpetuating system that just increases more militarism and causes more threats to civil liberties and to the concept of community policing and to the peace and security of communities. And, you know, we have to address not just the 1033 program and these grants, but the mentality behind it and the reason that these programs have sprung up in the first place.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO. Coming up this morning at 9 is the Old Mo Variety Hour. At 10 is Chris Andre, hosts Air Cascadia. Headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Locus Focus presents an encore program featuring journalist Elizabeth Colbert on her book, The Sixth Extinction. At 11, Grace Reed hosts Disability Awareness. At 11:30 on Radio Zine, we feature excerpts from a recent Portland panel discussion on the need to ban landmines. This event was organized by Lynn Bradack, an advocate with Handicap International. We will also hear from a retired American fighter pilot who dropped bombs on Laos during the Vietnam War. And we want to thank all you who are KBOO members for your continued generous support, and invite those of you who are not members to go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today so that we may continue to bring programs and guests such as our guest this morning, Elizabeth Beavers, who is with the Friends Committee on National Legislation. We're speaking on the militarization of local police forces, and we invite your calls here at 503-231-8187 or email us at moretalkradio@gmail.com. And let's go to George. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Cecil. I have a question for Ms. Beavers. Your suggestions are excellent. I think we need changes at the local level, but we need also Congress and the President. And isn't it about time, since we really have become a society split between people of color and white people, isn't it about time that the Quakers and all of us start thinking about generating a mass movement, something similar to what happened in the 60s, to oppose this entire increasing cycle of violence directed at our own citizens, and to put Congress in the situation where they know there are millions and millions of white people working with groups of people who are black and brown and people from the Philippines and all over the world who live here of different colors, that all of us are working together, and we are going to express ourselves in the street, and we are going to write or email or, you know, and contact people, and we are going to, by the millions, we're going to have to get out there, because Congress will respond, I think, mostly to the money which they stand to gain from corporate sponsors, and that includes the so-called defense industry, which has really become a very destructive global and national and dangerous problem. So isn't it about time to do that, and have the Quakers started thinking about how to do that? That's my question. I'll just hang up and take my answer off the
air.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Hey, well, thank you, George.
Thank you.
So tell us about the actions that the Friends are doing, and what we can do in terms of strengthening the movement against militarization and for peace and justice.
Right. Well, I mean, thank you so much, George, for your call. Speaking with a Quaker lobbyist, you couldn't say anything better than that you're looking for ways to express your support. I'm so happy to hear that. Yeah, you know, I think we really need to examine the tragic death of Michael Brown and the surrounding chaos that's happened since then. Is this a moment or is this a movement? And are we going to take this moment and reflect on it and then move on to something else? Or are we going to let this initiate a movement for change that consists of people across the ideological spectrum, people of different racial and socioeconomic backgrounds? You know, and I will tell people that even in Congress, this really is a unique issue that brings the left and the right together in a strange way. That's really fun for me to get to work with so many different types of offices, because there's a lot of interest here, whether it's progressive or libertarian or conservative, liberal, something in the middle. There are people who have some sort of concern about this increased militarization of police. You know, there are questions of big government. There's questions of government spending. There are questions of rights to privacy, due process, civil liberties, militarism. There's so many things that come into play here that it's the unique opportunity for people to express their support and to, you know, I hope that concretely, if people are looking to take action, the best thing they can do right now is ask for support for the Stop Militarizing Law Enforcement Act. It's the one that's being introduced by Congressman Hank Johnson of Georgia. He'll be introducing it right after the August recess when Congress comes back in early September. And the very best thing we could do is get a huge number of different kinds of members of Congress to sign on to that bill and to stand in solidarity and say that, regardless of background, that they're ready to see a change and they're ready to dramatically reform this program and turn back the clock on what's been happening for the past few years.
Thank you. We have another caller. Garrett,
Hi.
Good morning.
It's occurred to me that wherever there is profit, there is bribes, and bribes lead to corruption. So I've always thought that if the military-industrial complex is one of the greatest sources of corruption, and I know it is because Kennedy was assassinated right after warning us about the military-industrial complex. There's a very interesting speech, if you look it up on YouTube. It's posted under his Illuminati speech, but he does talk about the military-industrial complex. Maybe we just need to take profit and mass production of weapons out of private hands. Maybe no one anywhere should be allowed to profit from the manufacture of mass weapons and weapons of mass production, of mass destruction, and you know, warplanes and drones and all of that. You know, if we really, really need that as a society, maybe the Army should have its own production wing and completely take it out of private hands so that no one gets rich off of it and no one can use that money to buy our own politicians or to bribe anybody.
Thank you. So how do we break this monster of the profit from war, Ms. Beavers?
Boy, what a big question. I absolutely agree with the sentiment that if anyone's ever unsure why we're constantly at war, just check out who the number one employer in the world is, and of course it's the defense industry. We have become a society that thrives off of war manufacturing, and we profit from war, and there are local economies that depend upon it. So that's exactly right. What we have to do is take away that dependency on military manufacturing as a source of income and a source of stability. You know, there's actually an office in the Department of Defense that deals with this. It's the Office of Economic Adjustment, and their whole purpose is to help communities move away from economic dependence upon military manufacturing. That's something that we lobby on, is asking for more support for that office and trying to lift up alternatives, sustainable alternatives that don't depend on the country being in a constant state of war. That's exactly right. And that's why I said I hope that the president, when he's conducting this review, when he's asking Secretary Hagel to conduct this review of the 1033 program of police militarization, that they'll zoom back and they'll look at the bigger picture of how did we get here? Why is it that we're here in the first place? You know, I really like that ACLU, who good friends of ours, who co-hosted the briefing with us about a month ago, and they're supporting this bill as well. They put out a great report on police militarization. It talks about a lot of these underlying issues. And I love the title that they chose. They decided to call it The War Comes Home. Mm. And I think that's exactly what we're dealing with here. It's we have become so accustomed, it's become normalized that what we do, the way we respond to threats, is with unchecked war and unchecked funding and weapons for it. So it really isn't a surprise that what was once foreign policy and what was once international has directly come home. And I think that's why Ferguson has spawned so much interest, is because we have this capability now where we can watch it live. We see it on Twitter. We see it on YouTube. We can watch from our couches at home and wonder, is that going to be my town next? Is that going to be my city next? And the truth is that it could be, because for more than a decade now, the police and our communities have been stockpiling these weapons and equipment. And, you know, when the right opportunity comes along, there could be another Ferguson.
Let's go to our next caller. In a second, engineer is trying to do two things at once. Our next caller, Frances, good morning.
Hi. Appreciate your conversation this morning. I see it as, I view the prison industrial complex as also being something that's getting huge and out of control. I kind of see them. Military-industrial complex and the prison-industrial complex joining forces here. But I also hope and understand that this is an important issue, that we don't detract from the fact that even if they just had regular routine little semi-automatic pistols on their hips, the police department does kill people, whether it's militarized or not. Mm-hmm. It kills young African-American men at an alarming rate. And it doesn't happen just in Ferguson or New York City. It happens in every city in this country. And that issue should not be detracted from by discussing the militarization. because they kill people with chokehold, which does not require any kind of a military weapon, or with just regular guns. So hopefully, while we're discussing this very important issue, we don't detract from the fact that there's a very important other issue that should not be ignored.
Well, thank you, Francis, for raising those important points in terms of the fundamental question that Ferguson has highlighted is the role of the police and their continued antipathy to poor communities and communities of color, and what type of transformation we need in our society. Thank you for those thoughts. Certainly, we're familiar with the long history that the Quakers have in the movement for social justice. Could you speak to how the broader issue that Francis made the friends are addressing?
Yeah, and I'm so glad that Francis raised that, because let's remember that Michael Brown wasn't killed with, a sniper with an M16 on a tank. He was killed by a police officer with a routine gun. So that's absolutely right. If we're going to address these issues, we have to talk about the broader ones and why militarization affects people the way that it does. So here at the Friends Committee on National Legislation, we're working on a lot of related issues such as mass incarceration and poverty and issues that flood directly into this question. We have a lobbyist who's fantastic who's working on that, and we want to make sure exactly, as Francis says, not to hone in on just the 1033 program and miss the forest for the trees, and recognize that people suffer at the hands of brutality and overexerting of authority and of aggression, and that's comes quite often as a result of federal policies that we pursue that are focused disproportionately on, for example, the drug war and not addressing underlying causes of poverty and allowing people to be lifted up out of their circumstances. And these are things that we want to take as a whole, because that's exactly right, that the Friends do have a long history of not just working for peace, but also working for justice and working for equality within communities. So, it's something that we're going to continue to pursue, recognizing that this one 1033 program is a piece in the larger puzzle that we're trying to solve.
Thank you. And let's see if we can get in our last caller before we have to end. Mike, you have about 45 seconds.
So, quick question and a comment. Could you repeat the name of the bill that you want folks to lobby on? And the name of the committee of the American Service Friends Committee that is dealing with this issue, so that we can access that. And then my comment is simply, I keep thinking of Woody Allen in the movie The Front, talking about congressmen. He said, they're just congressmen. How much could they cost? So maybe we can bribe them too. Anyway, I'll leave it at that.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mike. Excellent conclusion. Give us the name of your organization, the legislation, and its number, and that type of information. Elizabeth.
Absolutely. I'm happy to. So I work for the Friends Committee on National Legislation. We are a Quaker-affiliated lobbying group here in Washington, D.C., and the bill that we're supporting is the Stop Militarizing Law Enforcement Act. It's incredibly important. Please ask your legislators to co-sponsor and support it. And you can get more information at fcnl.org/militarism. And again, that's FCNL, like Friends Committee on National Legislation, .org/militarism. I really hope everyone will reach out and start taking some concrete action, looking for support for the Stop Militarizing Law Enforcement Act.
Well, thank you. We've been speaking with Elizabeth Beavers with the Friends Committee on National Legislation. Let's work together to stop this awful program. Thank you, Ms. Beaver, for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And stay tuned for more great programming here on your community radio station, KBOO-FM. This is Cecil Prescott. We will see you at another time.
Boo is preparing for our legendary book and record sale happening on Sunday, September 14th at the Volunteers of America building, 537 Southeast Alder Street in Portland. We're accepting donations of books, comics, LPs, CDs, DVDs, VHS, and cassette tapes, and all donations are tax deductible. Your discards are another person's treasure, and all sales benefit your community radio station, KBOO. So bring those donations down to the station, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, during our business hours. For more information, please contact Jesse, 503-231-8032, extension 213, or online via email, volunteer@kboo.org. That's the annual book and record sale on Sunday, September 14th. As more and more of our men and women get caught up in the system of mass incarceration, the effect on family members cannot be ignored. Tune in to Prison Pipeline on August 25th at 6:30 p.m. to hear host Amy Johnson speak with members of Mothers of Incarcerated Sons Society. MISS is a group for people who are dealing with the incarceration of a loved one.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, Portland's only community-owned and democratically run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Joe Clement is our engineer. The Old Mole is dedicated to bringing you different perspectives on history, culture, politics, and current events than that of the corporate-owned conventional news media. Today, in the second half of hour of our today's program, Clayton Morgridge discusses what sort of political movements must be developed to make a real difference in the world. Closing our program, Ivan Hale gives us her thoughts on suicide and depression. Last week on Time Magazine's website, there appeared a controversy.